I think it is that time of the year when we do reflect on what matters for us as present and future citizens. And the review of our economy you're about to hear is one that somehow I don't think will end up sitting on the shelf like some worthwhile others do. It was released last month. It's hardly a sexy sounding topic, Australia's retirement income systems, but it's ended up illuminating a wider range of issues that are central to our way of life, like details of young people and housing, and it's been widely acclaimed as a valuable independent contributor to further debate, so we thought it deserved wider attention before the year ended. Yes, the headlines focused on its controversial features like the superannuation guarantee rate and related regulations about compulsory super, which drew out all the usual politics. But I'm delighted to say that the chair of the review panel, Michael Callaghan, joined me recently to offer some more explanation. He's had a long history in Federal Treasury. He's spent time as an IMF director and currently sits on various boards, including chairing the Aged Care Financing Authority. And I welcomed him.
Pleased to be here.
Mike, broadly, you were happy to report a system that's working, so that's good. But you also highlight some significant challenges to come for our whole community as a result of this same system. I'd like to hear you outline them, please. How do you see them?
Yeah, certainly. Well, it is a system that's working. I think it's important to start with that because in doing such reports like this, you can focus on the shortcomings, and if you just focus on the shortcomings, you can lose perspective on how the overall system's going. So we wanted to highlight that yes, the overall, the retirement income system, it is doing an adequate job. It's providing incomes for retirees, it's sustainable, it's quite effective. But there are elements where it needs to be improved. One of those, and this was the basis of the report to try and provide the facts and information and improve understanding of the system, what is clearly necessary is to help people understand the system, to get the most out of it. But also what is needed is information to have a more constructive policy dialogue debate over this. Another one I think that came out of it in terms of getting a better debate is that we do need to have a clear, agreed objective for what the retirement income system is trying to achieve with the system.
Well, look, to me, and I would characterise your view, you and your colleagues, as others have, as really emphasising the role that housing ownership plays in helping people fund a decent retirement in well-being or later life, and that in a way there's a little bit of a trade-off between the compulsory super system and the ability to compile a deposit for a first home. Now, is that something that the sort of strength of that surprised you?
Well, this is one where a number of people have asked me, why did the review make a recommendation that there should be early access to superannuation to get a deposit for the first home? The review made no recommendations and, in fact, made no comment at all about early access of superannuation to get a deposit for a home. What the review highlighted was that home ownership is a very important factor in determining whether people have an adequate retirement income. It's very important because if you go into retirement and own your home, you don't have the big outlays in terms of rent, but also the largest asset that most people have that they could draw on to support themselves, to supplement themselves in their retirement, is their home. And this is really, it really does determine whether you have an adequate retirement outcome is home ownership. Now, that's a fact, and that's we presented. In terms of what to do about it, it is sort of bringing two policy aspects together where, and forgetting about one. You can look at increasing demand for helping people get a first home, getting their deposit, but there's all the other aspects on the supply that determines whether people can get homing. So it's not just simply about early access to superannuation for retirement, which we didn't go into. It's a bigger issue about what does it take To allow people to get into their first home.
Jeremy Cooper, the last man who did a big review in 2010 about this, said precisely that, that changing the super system won't solve home ownership. But I know there's been some interesting writing by two people, Ron Bird and David Gallagher, writing in the Financial Review, saying that you look at the figures, there's a direct overlap, they say, more or less, between the introduction of compulsory super, and which takes out, 9.5% at least percent of people's, this is particularly for lower income people, and declining home ownership among younger people. Our super system, they write, is not designed for the poorer among us. It forces middle-income households to save for their retirement, which is a good thing. So maybe we need, as they suggest, a sort of sliding scale. At certain levels, you can access your super, or, as Kevin Davis from the University of Melbourne says, you borrow against it at a zero interest rate, if you know what I mean, because it's your money, all of which designed to boost this home ownership that you say does play a major role.
It's very healthy to have this debate, but again, it's not simply a question of resolving within the superannuation system, the retirement income system. There's all the other aspects of it all, in, as I was saying, in the supply of housing. In terms of just saying that there is this trade-off between introduction of the compulsory superannuation system and the decline in the ability for people to get into the
first home. Particularly poorer people, the lowest 30%.
But there are so many other aspects going on and influencing the demand for housing, population growth, etc. I think that's rather drawing a rather long bow. What is covered in the report is a look at some of the studies, or to the extent that there is some trade-off, people competing for the same savings dollar, whether it's home ownership or whether it is going into housing. And when you look at it, in terms of the data that we could find, there's, to some extent, some small changes in that. Some of it can be the opposite to what you've just said, that some people who have had higher superannuation and superannuation contributions have higher home ownership. Now, that can be really related to income. Yes, the poorer people, there is this trade-off, they can't save elsewhere. But it's not so definitive, I think, that to say that one's driving the other.
Okay, well, let's go to a couple. And this really is a development of what we're discussing. Does this system contribute to less or more equality within our society?
Well, in terms of equality in on the retirement income system, there's really two forces at play. Superannuation, because it's based to employment, the amount of super you have is going to depend on your engagement in employment. It's going to depend on how high your income is, how long you've worked, whether there's been any breaks in your working pattern, because the longer you work, the higher your income is, you're going to make more contributions to superannuation. And one area where there is this inequality is in between men and women, because men have higher incomes, not as many breaks in their working life as women, and the result is that men end up overall with higher superannuation balances. The drivers of this inequality come from inequality in working life.
Well, I thought I'd agree with you until I read aspects of your report. When you talk about the taxpayer subsidies, for instance, I think you estimate, or I think the budget papers estimate, that they're going to grow to more than $50 billion a year. This is on superannuation. And this massively goes, arguably, to intergenerational disadvantage. So when you have, at the same time, as 80% of people die with their super savings intact, handing them on to the next generation, you suddenly start to think, hang on, what is actually going on here?
This is, I think, the biggest problem that comes from that is people don't have the guidance, the information to be able to use the money they have to fund them to their retirement efficiently. And that does add to inequality. It does result in that there's this intergenerational transfer. People with the larger balances pass it on to their heirs. But to solve that problem, and some of the reasons for this, as we highlight in the report, people are afraid to spend their money in retirement. One, because they've been conditioned that they've got to build up their nest egg and they don't want to touch their nest egg. Two, they have this fear, how long will they live? Will they outlive their savings in retirement? Mm. Will they have big expenses, big health expenses, big aged care expenses? Will they be exposed to changes in the market? Now, as a result of all of that, people, it's a very complex, that's the other thing that does come out in our report, it is a very complex system. people go into retirement for all these fears and without much guidance. And we see in terms of the surveys, when people get the information that they can get the products that will solve some of these concerns they have, they will take them. And they're more satisfied in the retirement because those fears have been removed.
Well, I mean, that was a key part, if I read you correctly, of your critique, that there's a great emphasis on the accumulation stage of superannuation, constant sort of a reference to it, but not nearly enough on that next stage. And I'm rarely inclined to ask this question, but whose fault is that?
Well, at the moment, whose fault is it? It's hard to put your finger on whose fault on it. But people have particular interests in it. If we look at, for example, superannuation funds, their main concern is building up the balances that they have. So they put the emphasis on people, you need to save more. You need to put more money into super. You have to build up because they draw the fees from it. Now, that's put a lot of the focus on the accumulation phase. And this is the problem we have now, that there isn't been this focus on how you can best fund your retirement, use these savings. The government did, following the Murray report, it did say yes, and similar messages came out in Murray that we have too much focus on accumulation, that it did introduce this retirement income covenant concept that was going to put an obligation on the super funds that they had to look at what is the best outcome for people in retirement to draw down, not just have an account with your super.
I haven't seen much evidence, I've got to tell you.
Well, that's been deferred. It's more recently been deferred because of the pandemic, etc. But that's an important aspect that, and again, if it was a priority, we didn't make recommendations, but if I said what is one of the first priorities that needs to be done, people want to have accessible, affordable advice, that's important. But also, I think, more obligation on the players, particularly the superannuation funds, to worry about this retirement phase, to give people the better advice that they need and the products that they need to be able to make sensible decisions to draw down. As we highlight in the report, we have all this focus, for example, on whether we need to put more money into people's accounts, increases in the superannuation guarantee, for example. Yet we have, as identified in the reports, people not using it so efficiently. So if they don't use it efficiently, the outcome of putting more money into the accounts will be not that people will have achieved the retirement outcomes that people would consider adequate and what we're aiming for, but we would end up with even more inheritances.
Look, I've just got to ask you on the impact on wages, very controversial issue surrounded with, I think, quite confusing research, which often can sound like special pleading. I mean, it's just surrounded by politics at the moment. What decision did your panel reach after exploring rather deeply? Was there a trade-off there?
We looked at it, at the evidence that comes from this, and also the economic theory. And the evidence suggests that, and the conclusion we came to, is that, yes, there is this trade-off between increasing compulsory superannuation and wages. And this is very important because it goes to the fundamental objectives of the system. Really, do you believe that in saving for retirement, you have to forego something now to have that money later on to be able to spend? And that comes in the sense that, yes, because it's a portion of my income now, it's not in my wages, but I'm getting it in the ability to spend later. If you don't believe that's that trade-off, well, you could set any objective for your retirement income because the worker's not paying for anything for it. Yeah. In terms of the evidence, what we looked at is a lot of people have done a lot of work. We commissioned work by the ANU, the Tax Policy Institute. There's been work by Grattan, work by the Reserve Bank, international evidence on this. Some other studies looking at macroeconomic studies, essentially, and one of the problems of those is distinguishing the other factors that influence wages. The debate we're seeing now, people come out and say, hang on, we didn't have an increase in the SG in 2014, but wages didn't go up after that. Now, there are many other factors influencing wages. Superannuation is just one. It depends on the demand for labour. It depends on economic activity. You have to discount for that.
Now, final big question. As one newspaper put it, an epic political battle is underway, whether or not people quite realise it, over how we fund our retirements. Are you in any way suggesting, Mike, that the whole compulsory super system should change fundamentally and remove that element of compulsion? Are you suggesting that in any way?
No, not in any way. We do highlight in the paper that, yes, the superannuation, the compulsory component of it has been important, and it overcomes this bias that people have not saved for their retirement. But because it is compulsory, we believe it's important to make sure you get a balance, and starting from the position that there is a trade-off between what you consume in your working life and what you can consume in retirement, you should be trying to set your compulsory level such that you maximise your lifetime standard of living. So the objective in retirement is to maintain your living standards. The compulsory element of it is important, but what we're focusing on is what is the definition of that adequate retirement income, and we say it should be to try and maintain your living standards. If it's up to you, if it's your choice how much you want to forego now to be able to spend later, fine. But if it's compulsory, you shouldn't be imposing on someone to forego a lot of their standard of living in their working life to have a higher standard of living in retirement. It should be to smooth it.
Thank you very much indeed. I hope that has fleshed out quite a lot for listeners, and I do appreciate your time.
That's a pleasure, Jennifer.
Mike Callaghan, who's an economic consultant, and he was the panel chair of the Australia's Retirement Income Review, which, I, as I said to you, I don't think will just sit on the shelf. And quite a few of you have come back with remarks too.